world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like me. I'm Mike Boyum from Oshin, Iowa. I work for you as a USDA beef grader. We've been working overtime to fulfill Secretary Sonny Perdue's critical mission to do right and feed everyone. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Government lockdowns have serious consequences, especially keen in developing countries. We'll hear about the growing food crisis in parts of Asia and Africa.
If you have a shock to the system, then suddenly there can be a lot of food, but it's sitting somewhere on the other side of an ocean.
Also, it's been 1 year since the Bahamas got hit by Hurricane Dorian. We'll hear how it's going there now. Plus, another one of our 2020 Hope Award recipients.
On my way back from town over to wherever I was staying, come by, coffee was cheap, people are great, a lot of good connections.
And world commentator Ryan Baumberger.
It's Tuesday, September 8th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Up next, Kent Covington has today's news.
President Trump marked Labor Day at the White House by touting the country's economic recovery. He said jobs are coming back strong, but that won't continue if his opponent wins in November.
We're currently witnessing the fastest labor market recovery from an economic crisis in history. By contrast, Biden presided over the worst, the weakest, and the slowest economic recovery since the Great Depression.
The president also said while COVID-19 has taken a heavy toll, the U.S. economy has held up better than those of other Western nations. And he predicted that a proven vaccine will be available by the end of the year. But his Democratic rival Joe Biden fired back as he spoke to supporters in Pennsylvania.
More than 6 million people infected with COVID. They're heading toward the 200,000, above 200,000 range of people who have died from COVID. And he still has no plan.
But the White House has also been pointing to improving infection rates in many parts of the country. Florida on Monday reported the lowest number of new coronavirus cases in almost 3 months. The state reported just over 1,800 new cases, the fewest since June 15th. Positivity rates and deaths related to COVID-19 are also dropping. But health officials across the state are bracing for a possible rise in new cases after Labor Day gatherings and an influx of tourists. Umbrellas sprouted up at popular beaches over the weekend as most beaches remained open. Experts have pointed to gatherings on Memorial Day weekend and the July 4th holiday as likely culprits in earlier upticks and infections. President Trump has ordered the federal government to halt certain types of diversity training, which he sees as divisive anti-American propaganda. World's Lee Jones has more.
Federal agencies will identify spending tied to programs on white privilege, critical race theory, or any other content that presents any race as, quote, inherently racist or evil. Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vogt, issued the notice on Trump's orders. He said the administration will provide further guidance on the training sessions. Vogt cited press reports in which federal employees had to say they benefit from racism, and instructors said virtually all white people contribute to racism. He said such training runs counter to American principles and engenders resentment within the workforce. In a tweet, President Trump called critical race theory a sickness that cannot be allowed to continue. Reporting for World, I'm Lee Jones.
As a huge wildfire roars through California's Sierra National Forest, officials on Monday expanded evacuation orders. They urged people in more mountain communities to leave the area. That as fire crews battled dozens of blazes amid a record-setting heat wave. Rescuers flew more than 200 people to safety over the weekend after a fire surrounded Mammoth Pool Reservoir northeast of Fresno. California Army National Guard Colonel David Hall told reporters.
The crews were absolutely ecstatic when they came off the helicopters. All of the individuals that they rescued were greeting the crew members with hugs as they were boarding onto the helicopter, and then again, after getting off the helicopter, a lot of high fives.
And to the south, flames wiped out about 30 houses in the remote town of Big Creek. Sheriff's deputies went door to door to make sure residents were complying with orders to leave. The blaze, called the Creek Fire, has charred well over 100 square miles of lush forest. Meantime, in Southern California, several fires are burning, including one in eastern San Diego County and another that closed mountain roads in Angeles National Forest. Scorching temperatures are partially fueling the fires. Downtown L.A. reached 111 degrees on Sunday, and a nearby part of the San Fernando Valley recorded a record-shattering high of 121. A Saudi court has handed down sentences to eight people involved in the 2018 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. World's Kristen Flavin has that story.
The court ordered a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison for five people. Another person received a 10-year sentence, and the court ordered two others to serve 7 years behind bars. It did not name any of the people sentenced. But the case continues to cast a shadow over Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He has denied ordering the hit against Khashoggi, but the intelligence communities of the United States and many other countries aren't buying it. Critics of Saudi Arabia's trial note that no senior officials nor anyone suspected of ordering the killing has been found guilty. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
German doctors treating Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny said Monday that they've been able to take him out of a medically induced coma as his condition has slowly improved. Navalny was flown to Germany last month after falling ill on a domestic flight in Russia. German scientists said last week that tests showed proof without doubt that he was poisoned with the chemical nerve agent from the Novichok group. That's the same type of Soviet-era chemical used to poison former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter in England 2 years ago. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told reporters over the weekend,
NATO allies agree that Russia now has serious questions it must answer. The Russian government must fully cooperate with the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons on an impartial international investigation.
The Russian government is not cooperating. It denies any involvement and claims Russian doctors found no evidence that he was poisoned. Navalny is a fierce and high-profile critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, economic pain outweighs virus fears in poor communities. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Tuesday, the 8th of September, 2020. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Nick Iyer.
And I'm Mary Reichard. First up, pandemic pain in the developing world. Government-ordered lockdowns in wealthy nations have caused serious economic and social damage. But in poorer developing countries, the consequences are even more severe.
World Sarah Schweinsberg reports now on some of the problems facing Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and South America.
3 years ago, the Myanmar military drove an ethnic Muslim minority group called the Rohingya out of the country. Since then, they've been living in Bangladesh in a refugee camp, nearly a million strong. Frederick Christopher directs the Rohingya refugee response for World Vision. Before COVID-19, Christopher says many Rohingyan adults left the camp each day to work.
Almost like about 30 to 40% of the Rohingya people And they are engaged in work.
In March, the Bangladeshi government ordered the camp into lockdown, along with the rest of the country. So for 6 months now, the Rohingya haven't been able to leave, and fewer aid workers can come into the camp. Frederick Christopher says so far, only 3% of Rohingyas have contracted COVID-19.
Around 58 deaths so far has happened, but not that much.
Frederick Christopher says with parents under economic pressure, the camp has seen an uptick in child labor, child marriages, and trafficking.
They are saying that they're not worried about COVID attacking them, but they're really worried about the safety and security and of the children.
These are the cost-benefit calculations of lockdowns in many developing countries. The International Food Policy Research Institute estimates that as a result of restrictions designed to stop the virus from spreading, 140 million people will slip back into extreme poverty, living on less than $2 per day. The United Nations says as many as 300,000 people a day could die from starvation and disease due to lockdown fallout. That's many more than COVID-19 has killed. Jay Richards is a scholar at the Discovery Institute and a business professor at the Catholic University of America. He says these estimates are based on computer modeling that could be wrong, but
even if the malnutrition and deaths are a tenth of what the UN is predicting, it would still be a catastrophe. The problem is not that we don't have enough food. It's that getting food where it needs to go at the right time and having...
Even before the pandemic, countries like Yemen, Burkina Faso, and Venezuela were already facing extreme food shortages because of conflict, flooding, and drought. Richard says lockdowns, border closures, and supply chain disruptions have drastically exaggerated these challenges.
If you have a shock to the system, then suddenly there can be a lot of food, but it's sitting somewhere on the other side of an ocean in shipping containers getting rotten when the people that actually need it don't have access to it.
In South Sudan, two-thirds of the country already depended on food aid. Dr. Mesfin Loha is World Vision's director there. He says lockdowns led to more supply shortages and inflated prices.
Because the countries required the trucks, the drivers, and other stuff to get tested at the border with very long delays, sometimes up to 3 weeks, 4 weeks. So that really delayed supplies, shipments into the country.
Dr. Loha says social distancing precautions have also hampered humanitarian efforts.
For example, a food distribution program that could take 1 week could take up to 3 weeks because we only take a few people at a time. The physical distancing arrangement, the temperature checking arrangements, and also the hand washing facilities.
Noah Gottschalk is a humanitarian policy advisor at Oxfam America. He says lockdowns are also affecting agriculture output in developing countries.
Farmers who are unable to access seeds, farmers who are unable to bring their goods to market because of restrictions on travel. We see pastoralists, people who care for herd animals, who are unable to migrate with those animals. And
access to medical services has also become strained across parts of Africa and Asia. Dr. John Fielder is the chief executive at African Mission Healthcare and works at a hospital in Kajabi, Kenya. He says because of travel challenges and stretched resources like oxygen and COVID-19 tests, fewer people are visiting for checkups or getting elective procedures.
Unfortunately, I fear that over time we're going to see spikes in cases of tuberculosis and maternal mortality as a result of COVID, the measures that had to be taken to control it.
Dr. Fielder points out that even in neighboring Tanzania, a country that did not lock down, fear of the coronavirus still kept people away from hospitals.
So it's almost like, well, if you lock down, you're going to interrupt these operations. If you didn't lock down, you're also going to interrupt operations.
With extremely limited testing in poorer nations, it's difficult to tell whether lockdowns have succeeded in stopping the spread of COVID-19. Some worry a silent epidemic is raging. But so far, official case counts and deaths are lower than anticipated. Dr. Fielder says one reason, populations in poorer countries are very young.
You know, only 10% of Kenyans are over the age of 50. And so, yes, things haven't been as bad as we thought, but a big part of that is because of the steps that were taken. Whether those benefits are going to be outweighed by some of these indirect costs, I don't think we know the answer to that yet.
Reporting for World, I'm Sarah Schweinsberg.
Additional support comes from ConquerSeries.com, helping more than 1 million men break free from pornography. Freedom today at ConquerSeries.com. And from the Masters University, a commitment to Christ and Scripture drives everything that happens on campus, both in and out of the classroom. More at masters.edu.
Coming up next on The World and Everything In It, hurricane recovery in the Bahamas. 1 year ago this month, Hurricane Dorian tore through the Caribbean, devastating the northern islands of the Bahamas. More than three-quarters of the homes on the island of Abaco suffered damage. The destruction totaled an estimated $3.4 billion.
Christian aid groups quickly moved in to help with repair and recovery. Samaritan's Purse was among the first to arrive. Daniel Ruiz is a deputy country director with the organization, and he joins us now from Freeport to talk about how the work is progressing. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to speak.
Well, I'd like to hear how things are in those hardest hit areas. Is rebuilding progressing quickly? Much damage remain?
We've just passed the year mark since Hurricane Dorian made landfall, and certainly a lot of work has been done through Samaritan's Purse, other organizations, the government, but a lot of work remains. With the level of destruction that Abaco experienced, it's going to be still a long road to recovery yet laying ahead. A lot of homes have been repaired. Electricity has been restored to many areas, not all. Same with water distribution. So the water network has been restored in many areas, but there are still communities that are without electricity. They're without running water. They still have significant damages to their homes. Businesses are still struggling to rebuild, repair. Certainly, the difficulty with the global COVID pandemic, which I can mention some impact from that as well, is affecting the tourism industry, which the Bahamas relies heavily on for their economy.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people were displaced shortly after the hurricane hit. Have some of those people been able to come home?
Definitely. When we saw at the new year in 2020, January of 2020, we saw an uptick in the number of returnees being able to come back to Abaco. And we've seen that throughout the course of this year. Slowly, people have tried to return. Just anecdotally through our hiring process, we've got a large number of local Abaconian staff. There is a shortage of housing. And so for those who wish to return, they want to come back, restart their livelihoods. Maybe they have job opportunities, but the housing isn't there. So it remains the key barrier to the complete return of residents from before the storm.
And you did mention how much tourism has been affected by COVID. Most of the tourism stopped in March, and here we are in September, same thing going on. How is the economy there doing, and how has that affected the recovery effort?
Yeah, with respect to the economy, in particular for Abaco and in Grand Bahama, obviously the closure of international borders in the Bahamas earlier this year as a result of the global pandemic put a full stop to incoming cruisers on the cruise lines and tourists flying in to the country through the summer period. Certainly that's had an impact on the macro economy of the country, but the effects are felt all the way down to local business owners who have on Abaco. They have been able to rebuild and restart. And then for Grand Bahama, all of the small business owners that perhaps were able to get their business going pretty quickly after Hurricane Dorian hit. And then they were hit with the pandemic and the shutdown of the country and international travel. So it's kind of been hit with a 1-2 punch, and it's they're still in the midst of that.
What about churches in the islands? Have they fared well enough in the last year? Are they active in rebuilding efforts?
You know, one of the greatest blessings for me being here with Samaritan's Purse has been seeing the local church in the midst of the destruction and, you know, pastors and church leaders going through all of that themselves through Hurricane Dorian and the COVID pandemic. They've bounced back spiritually, though their physical structures may still be in disrepair. The church has done a tremendous job of reaching out to the communities, providing, you know, being a place where people can come for prayer, for spiritual, emotional support. And I can mention a couple of our projects that we've been able to kick off, again, despite the COVID pandemic. We've initiated a program where we're training pastors and church members on how to respond both physically and spiritually after a crisis. And so giving them kind of practical skills on things that they can do in the immediate aftermath of a disaster. And then once you transition from covering immediate physical needs, how to meet the spiritual and emotional needs of people who have gone through that crisis. And that's been really well received. We've got great participation in those projects, and we're grateful that we can impart those skills on people, because Samaritan's Purse won't be here forever, and we want to leave behind a stronger local church that can respond in future disasters.
Wonderful to hear that. Daniel Ruiz is a deputy country director with Samaritan's Purse, one of the Christian aid groups working on hurricane recovery efforts in the Bahamas. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, you know, sometimes you just have to take a stand. For a young man in Lincoln, Nebraska, it was just such a time. At a city council meeting last week, he found the courage to speak the truth. Civic leaders, he said, for far too long, our city has been living a lie.
I go into nice family restaurants and I see people throwing this name around and pretending as though everything is just fine. I'm talking about boneless chicken wings. I propose that we as a city remove the...
He's just getting started here and making some excellent points, by the way, such as nothing about boneless chicken wings actually comes from the wing of a chicken.
Boneless chicken wings are just chicken tenders, which are already boneless. I don't go to order boneless tacos. I don't go and order boneless club sandwiches. I don't ask for boneless auto repair.
And why would you? Christensen proposed the city of Lincoln call on restaurants to rename these so-called boneless chicken wings.
We can call them buffalo-style chicken tenders. We can call them wet tenders. We can call them saucy nugs or trash.
You know, this is government solving problems. Christensen, as it turns out, is the son of a member of the city council, and he ended this impassioned plea by declaring it is time for change, and we know it, you know it, we all know it, because we feel it in our bones.
Truth in advertising.
It's the world and everything in it. Today is Tuesday, September 8th. You're listening to World Radio, and we're so glad you are. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, the Hope Award for Effective Compassion, Part 3. Anna Johansson takes us to a cafe in Cambridge, Maryland. It's a nonprofit that seeks to bridge the gap between two very different sides of town.
The Overflow Cafe is stationed at an odd intersection. If you walk north a block, you're in the upscale business district. If you walk a block south, you're in a pretty rough neighborhood. The cafe has floor-to-ceiling glass windows and enormous potted plants and palm trees inside. The tables are painted with a swirling blend of bright colors. The food is inexpensive, $2.50 or $3 for a sandwich, 75 cents for a cup of coffee. Dudley Parr and his wife, Anna, took charge of the Overflow Cafe in 2014.
You can get almost any drugs you want within 100 yards of here.
Parr has a long gray ponytail and pale blue eyes. We talk over the humming drone of an industrial refrigerator. The cafe draws people from both sides of town, and Parr says the location is deliberate. He wants those different groups to mix. In fact, that's why the Overflow Cafe exists. It's a place where all kinds of people are welcome. People like Eddie. He's a bit of a character.
In case you see buzzards circling, you'll pop in and make sure it's not me.
Eddie has long white hair down to his elbows and wears a battered captain's hat. He's lived rough for a while, spent a number of years homeless, and just recently moved into the building next door. He's been coming to the Overflow Cafe almost since the day it opened.
On my way back from town over to wherever I was staying, when it was open, come by, coffee was cheap, people are great, a lot of good connections.
He helps out around the cafe, fixing computers and appliances in exchange for free coffee. That happens a lot at the Overflow. Most of the staff behind the counter are volunteers, people from the community who need a simple job. Some of them just want to keep busy so they stay out of trouble. Others need job experience. The Parrs train them to work in the cafe, and they introduce basic workplace etiquette. If a volunteer keeps showing up late, they get removed from the team. The bars aren't as strict as a real employer, but they start building that expectation. You need to show up to work on time, and you need to work in exchange for food.
Okay, so you saw Tommy come in, I think, a couple times today. He's got glasses, short guy, beard. So Tommy, when he's got money, he's buying drugs. So he either comes to us because we'll give him a cup of coffee, we'll give him water. Well, now he's kind of gotten into this thing like he's coming by regularly looking for the handout. Now we're getting to where we're enabling him.
The PARs want to be generous and loving, but they don't want to enable people to stay in the same broken lifestyle.
So, yeah, Tommy, I can't keep giving you this stuff. Yeah, I got dishes to do. I got things to sweep up.
They turn it into an exchange instead of a handout. Monica is a brand new volunteer. She just started training today.
It's very, very nice here. People are friendly, great environment. It's peaceful here.
She came by the cafe and met Dudley Parr a few years ago.
I probably was having a problem or something that day, and he couldn't tell on my face, I guess. And he was like, you know, do you need to talk? And I was like, sure. He helped me out.
That relational aspect of the cafe is a huge part of its mission. Parr says working alongside people gives you a chance to get to know them and talk about deeper spiritual issues.
As we get to know folks and they start sharing things about their lives, and then, well, have you ever, or well, where did you go to church? Did you grow up in the, you know, just finding out those kinds of things. And
the Overflow Cafe doesn't have any official programs. There are a number of AA meetings that gather here weekly, but the cafe doesn't have any classes or an application process or a year-long program to get a person a job and a house. Instead, it's all about conversational evangelism.
It's always, you know, the evangelism discipleship is very much individualized because of who they are and where they are.
It's messy. There's a lot of trauma, a lot of addiction. But Dudley and Anna Parr work through it with each person. Sometimes they get the joy of seeing someone profess faith in Christ. Parr has done baptisms, weddings, and funerals.
We've done three funerals, two for guys who we baptized. But to be able to do, to be able to give the eulogy and to be able to say, I know I will see him again, to feel confident where they were in their faith, to be able to hear from other people the change that was, you know, that was became obvious in their life. That's the, those are some of the successes as a.
The Overflow Cafe isn't a massive structured organization. In one sense, it's just ordinary people living on a mission, ministering to their broken neighbors.
Part of the vision is to actually see this become the norm, not just having a cafe, but to have people in the churches in Cambridge engaged outwardly in ways that make a difference, that take the kingdom to people.
Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson in Cambridge, Maryland.
Tuesday, September 8th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Nick Iger.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Here now is world commentator Ryan Bomberger.
One would think that racial justice would include removing those systems that deliberately target black and brown lives for death. One would think. But Democrat Party leaders want to do the exact opposite. For the past few years, they've been trying to undo a legal protection that 43% of House Dems and 63% of Republicans passed in 1976. It's called the Hyde Amendment, named after the late pro-life Congressman Henry Hyde. The original legislation prohibited the federal government from funding abortions except when the mother's life was physically endangered. Congress later added rape and incest exceptions. In a 2003 debate on the partial birth abortion ban, Hyde gave a good summary of the reason for pro-life laws.
The people you pretend to defend, the powerless, those who can't escape, who can't rise up in the streets, those are the ones that ought to be protected by the law. The law exists to protect the weak from the strong.
The Hyde Amendment has always been strongly bipartisan, but now some Democrats claim it is a racist policy. Quote, It's an issue of racial justice, and it's an issue of discrimination, California Democrat Barbara Lee recently declared. She was the same pro-abortion politician who denounced my organization's pro-life, Black and Beautiful billboard campaign a few years ago. The Radiance Foundation highlighted abortion's hugely disproportionate impact in the Black community and promoted TooManyAborted.com. The tagline was, "One is too many." Not so for liberals like Lee, who denounced our billboards, along with Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, and the NAACP. Yes, the NAACP, too, which called our life-affirming ad campaign, quote, "horribly racist on the face of it," and "gives the false impression that Planned Parenthood kills Black babies," end quote. But they do. Millions of them since Roe v. Wade. In fact, Planned Parenthood kills an estimated 360 Black lives every single day. What form of justice invites more death into communities already ravaged by violence and death? How is saying too many Black babies are aborted is racist, but promoting the lie that not enough are aborted is justice? Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley and New York's Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are leading this charge. African-American Congresswoman Pressley tweeted, quote, "This is a racial justice issue. It denies low-income and disproportionately women of color access to reproductive health care. Hyde's days need to be numbered," end quote. This argument is not based in fact. Just look at Massachusetts, where Black Americans make up 9% of the state's population, but they represent 20% of the state's abortions. Whites make up 80% of the state's population, but account for only 47% of the state's abortions. There's no lack of access. Ocasio-Cortez is one of those who says abortion is healthcare, but if abortion is healthcare, slavery was job care. In her home state of New York, more Black babies are aborted than born alive. For every 1,000 born alive, there are 1,033 aborted. Black and brown babies are the most aborted in New York City. As someone conceived in rape, yet adopted in love, as someone with brown skin and four brown children, I just have one question for pro-abortion Democrats. What exactly is the right number of deaths of unborn Black and brown lives? I'm Ryan Bomberger.
Tomorrow, presidential polling will tell you how pollsters collect data and how that can influence the results. And we'll introduce you to our fourth Hope Award winner. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow.